Hello and welcome. Today I am joined by Colin Lewin, who is, as I'm sure you'll know, a physiotherapist, and he's also the co-founder at the Lewin Clinic. So, Colin, how are you doing?
Good, thanks. Thanks for having me on.
No problem. So, what have you been up to today?
Today I had a full morning in clinic, various bits and pieces, various injuries, some new ones, some old ones come through the door. Same old story, really. But yeah, good day. Good day so far.
Very good. So yeah, I'm looking forward to going back over your career. I've already had Gary on and several other people from the football community. So like, where are you from originally?
Yeah, I've seen the list of people you've had on. That's a good list of people there. Where am I from originally? I grew up in East London, not far from West Ham's ground, actually. And that was me. And then ended up from there at University of Brighton doing the physio BSc there. Came out of that in 95, and following a conversation with Gary, actually a West Ham Leeds game, bizarrely. Went over to help him out at Arsenal, originally working with the youngsters over there. So that's how that happened, really.
And what was that, what made you want to go into the that world of physiotherapy in the first place? That how big a career was it at that point?
The strange thing was, when I was doing A levels, I picked some A levels that I thought I was good at. I hadn't really had any idea about career at that time, and was having conversations with various people, like everyone does, about what next. And Gary had mentioned that he thought I might quite enjoy physio. No mention of football. That was never the plan, really. He would just really enjoy the physiotherapy stuff. So I liked the idea of it. Really enjoyed university. Loved all the hospital placements and stuff like that we did there. And I suppose the plan would have been into a London hospital, one of the big teaching places, and go from there. The plan wasn't really sport particularly, although you're often going to have an eye on it. And then it happened probably sooner than it should have done. I sort of fell into the working with the youth team. There was no academies then as such, working with the youth team, reserve teams at Arsenal. And that's really how it happened. And then, yeah, that was a 3 or 4 year period that went very quickly from I don't know what I want to do to, oh, I'm qualified. Here I am at Arsenal. It was a quick transition, really.
So when you went into, was that the Reok era then? If you were in
Yeah.
95, was he there then? So that was like in a real transitional period for the club. You're getting the likes of Bergkamp in and
Yeah. We joined the same day, funny. Me and a few of those players were all our first day was together. And yeah, it was Reok. And he did about 15, 16 months there.
who
Different.
else joined on your first day then?
I think it was Dennis Bergkamp, David Platt. Someone's going to correct me. I'm sure some Stetto somewhere, but I'm pretty sure Dennis Bergkamp, David Platt, at the old training ground, which was very, very basic for people that have been there. Yeah, and it was a time where Arsenal were doing okay. They'd been in a couple of European finals in the few years before, but it was a very different place to what it ended up being years later.
And how big a football fan were you then?
Yeah, I was, well, I was not a player, let's get that right. I played football, but to no level. Yeah, no, I was going to a lot of Arsenal games, mainly through Gary, really. Just going to watch games. I mean, I'd been to a lot of West Ham fans as a youngster. And then started going to Arsenal in my very early teens just because the tickets were available. And yeah, so not some huge mad Arsenal fan, but to go in there and work there was really good. It was a good level of club with really good players that had aspirations of Europe, of course.
And so what was it like? I mean, going in like Bergkamp, that a lot of people cite that as being a massive shift of getting someone over from Inter, wasn't it, he signed from. But also like David Platt, again, huge name English player. So from your perspective, you're only quite a young guy. That how did you feel? Were you like overawed or like what was your
No,
general
not really.
feeling?
Not really. I spent a lot of time with Gary there in the years before when I was a student. I was doing bits and pieces there in the holidays. And, I was working mainly with the kids in the reserves. I was helping Gary out occasionally. But yeah, you'd see these players every day. It didn't really mean there was no overawed, really. It was, a great togetherness with the staff at that time. Really good youth team with really good coaches looking after the youth team, the Pat Rices of the world, who, yeah, just made the day a place, a good place to be. And it was, yeah, I was mainly with the reserves and the youth team at that stage.
Were there any players, who were the players that came through into the first team from those then?
Good question. Fairly soon after I joined, I suppose Ashley Cole would have been coming through. Yeah, you're testing me there now. I'm looking through my first couple of youth teams. I'm not sure anyone did, to be honest. Not sure anyone did. No, the first few youngsters to come through would have been the Ashley Coles of the world, really.
Wasn't he a striker? I'm sure I heard somewhere that he was a striker.
Way back, perhaps. But no, I wouldn't know about that. I think in the Arsenal, youth teams, he was certainly a fullback.
Yeah. And so going into that, like in terms of the environment, what was it like in terms of the shift from, you've got someone like Bruce Rioch, who people might say, I don't know much about, but like more of an old school type manager, which may be right or wrong, to then having Wenger coming in? Like, how did that differ?
Difficult to say, really. I think I wouldn't say Bruce Rioch was particularly old school at all. I think Arsene was just a new face that none of us had heard of. We were assured that he was, you know, a good, fair man who'd done well in various management roles before. I mean, the world, the English football world was quite insular then. We knew England and that was it. Didn't know much else about the rest of Europe, let alone the world. No, and Arsene just came in and was sitting back and seeing what needed to change, really. There was no big, massive changes. Couple of changes in training, perhaps. Preparation was very big on the professionalism thing, but then so was Bruce Rioch. I think Arsene's benefit was that the training ground burned down within a year of him being there. So suddenly we didn't have this real old school changing rooms type area with a bit of a gym set up out the back. It burnt down. So we had to stay at a local hotel, base ourselves at a local hotel every day, called Sotwell House, and that's where we were from the season 97-98 when we won the double. We were based in a hotel. We had to get a bus down every day to train on the pitches, all back on the bus covered in mud and stuff, back to the hotel to get changed. We had a medical room set up there and everything. So in that year, Arsene would have been instrumental in thinking, right, we're not going back there. We're going to get our own training ground. And a lot of things happened, including the sale of Nicholas Anelka for, you know, 23, 24 million, I think. And with that money, the club cleverly invested in a load of land and built this wonderful new training ground, which we all had a part in helping to design. So that was the biggest thing that Arsene had on his side, was Arsene, you know, a fire at the training ground on a very windy night, which basically burnt it to the ground and probably set in motion the building of the training ground as it is now.
And so when you're looking to put something together there, it did feel like it from an external perspective that things were changing. The Premier League was getting more and more mature. So did you see a shift from the medical and training setup? Was that changing a lot at that point?
Well, we had better facilities suddenly. I mean, the original training ground was very basic. Certainly no swimming pool, no hydro pool. Certainly no purpose-built gym. All the basics that you expect now at a Premier League training ground just weren't there. Now, I know we're going back 25 years, but it wasn't there. So the facilities thing drove it, of course, because suddenly we had much better pitches to train on. We had our gym how we wanted it. There was a hydro pool, a much bigger medical room, so it wasn't so busy and bumping into each other. So from the facilities side, that was good. Then we started to get a couple more staff in place. The academy system started to come along, and we put an academy physio in place. I then moved up to the first team around that time, 98-ish, to be Gary's assistant as such with the first team. And yeah, I suppose that changed. Slowly staff numbers started to increase. Facilities were much improved. And I suppose that was the big turning point, really, when that change around the training grounds was a big feeder for everything else. I think, because then the nutrition improved, of course. We could have our chef doing our food at our times. So it all fell from there, really, like one big domino.
But yeah, so sort of the timing kind of was all, there's a couple of different things going on with Wenger and the training grounds.
Yeah, having our own training ground allowed him to put in place what he wanted. If he wanted certain gym sessions or certain preparation sessions to happen, they could at the new training ground. Wouldn't have been so easy in the old one. If he wanted his nutrition, again, wouldn't have been so easy in the old one.
Yeah.
I say his nutrition, you know, the advice we had from nutritionists at that time. Mm. So yeah, it was obviously winning the double in 98 helps things. That helps buy some belief, doesn't it? So I think that certainly helped him with getting his message across.
And yeah. Then,
you know, he did very well in the years after that.
So then you still got some massive players in that era before Wenger going in and the 98 double winning team, because you got Tony Adams, Merson, Ian Wright, like those sort of, again, look like big characters. So like in terms of like the change for those guys, they progressed and still were successful in that sort of era as well. But what was it like from your side, like with those sort of players and the change in things? Was there a big difference from the player perspective in terms of what they expected from the medical team from you?
No, I don't think so. I think perhaps numbers increased a little bit. I think, remember David Platt coming in, he had played in Italy and was surprised there was no massage therapist at the club. You know, it might be an idea to get a massage therapist. Okay, David, well, what made you say that? He said, well, in Italy, a lot of the clubs have them. Okay, we'll give it a try. Spoke to the club, no problem, here's the budget. Went and got ourselves a massage therapist. And I suppose that did help. It did. Was another pair of hands for certain parts of the day. So, yeah, I think the staffing level started to increase. Like I say, the academy systems were coming in around that time. So that sort of separated itself from the first team a bit. They had their own staffing. So there's that to say. Yeah, what was your question?
You know, just really seeing, like, in terms of, like, the players, like, what you mentioned it there.
Yeah, I think I've heard Lee Dixon say before and a couple of others that they felt that Arsene helped extend their career by a year or two. Now, that would have been driven by perhaps a bit more thorough in regards to preparation, warm-ups, strength sessions, recovery days a bit more structured. And also Arsene, for a period, was letting the over-30s go in. There was a certain training session every now and then. Well, over-30s, in you go. You know, which had no great science behind it, but in his eyes, you lads have done enough now, in you go. So, you know, the day you were hitting your 30th birthday, a lot of players are thinking, lovely, I missed that last 20 minutes of that session. So, yeah, I think sending in Tony Adams, Lee Dixon, Steve Bold, Martin Keown, sending those boys in sometimes when a session was perhaps towards the riskier side for them, did it buy them extra time? We'll never know, but they certainly think so.
Then we'll come on to more of the modern day as well. But again, you look at those players that you've mentioned, they seem like such big personalities. And how different have things changed in terms of the players' mentalities? Or I don't know, because there's obviously the media is massive now, and it's how much is it blown out of proportion? Like, do the characters change much from the players, do you think, from then to now?
Excuse me. I don't think so. Not really. I think it's easy to look back at those four I've named there and think, oh, they're English, you know, and there's a big English core then. But no, I don't think so. Obviously, it became very multinational, international around that time. I think when I joined, there were 3 foreign players in the squad. When I left, there were 17, 18 different nationalities. So, you know, in that 23 seasons, one thing that very clearly changed was the diversity and demographic of where the players were coming from. So I don't think you can say no, just because they were English, they were a different mentality, really. I think we had some real strong characters that came in, French, Dutch, Russian, whatever. So no, I don't think so. I think that's a slight media-fed myth, really.
Yeah, and then like you mentioned some of those, like Vieira, Petit and Overmars, those guys, again, just absolute icons of the game. And so at that point, probably the Premier League wasn't seen as like the pinnacle, which it probably is now. So when they were coming over, with, in terms of like David Platt saying about massage therapists, were they coming to you saying they expected this, or there were different inputs that they were getting that they were guessing at Ajax or Milan?
Not really. I think David Platt was only only real example because he was considered a senior player. You know, played a lot for England by then. He was a senior player who had, had his thoughts on it and came to see us. But we weren't getting lots of players knocking on the door saying, we did this at Ajax, we did this at Marseille, wherever it was. So no, that wasn't really happening. I think it was still considered a big club then. And you're talking about my very early years, so it's hard for me to fully remember. But the players you mentioned there were in my first 5 years. So this always helps when you're winning games. In that 98 to 2004 period, whatever it is, we did win an awful lot. So I think whatever message you're putting across, I think people start to buy in because you're looking at results and thinking, well, it's working. It's not always the case, is it? But it helps get your point across.
Yeah, some of the players, not even mentioned Henri, those sort of players. But they're obviously super talented players, physically great, technically really good. From a mentality perspective, did you see anything in them that, obviously there was something in them, but like, what were the particular mental characteristics that you saw that helped to be successful?
That's a tricky question because I think it was more the team at the time rather than the individuals. I think you can talk about, you know, the mentality of Jens Lehmann, and where do I stop? I can name many, but I think it was the togetherness of that team, really. I mean, it's obvious to go to the Invincibles, isn't it? But I think that team in 2002, which won the double, you know, winning it at Man United, and you know, a lot of trophies were won in that period, a lot weren't won, but we were very close for most of those 6-7 years to winning a lot of trophies. So it was a team thing. It wasn't particularly an individual mentality, in my memory anyway. Of course, you need a group of individually mental, not mental, strong mentally players. But I think, looking back, all the Invincible documentaries that have been out recently that you've seen have always talked about that togetherness of that team, whether they were senior or the younger boys like the Fabregases and the Senderosses and the Colo Touré's. Leaders is the biggest thing. If you've got a group of experienced natural leaders, whatever that means, I think if you've got a group of three or four leaders, you end up self-policing. You don't need to worry about discipline. You don't need to worry about people being late. You've got a dressing room that's policing itself. And we did have a real big group of senior leaders, 5 or 6 players in that squad, which made it easy.
Yeah. And that, does it put pressure on you in the medical department? Like these guys coming in, I'm sure they'd be like assertive, know what they want. Do they put pressure on you to be developing them, or how does that work from the medical standpoint?
No, I think every now and then you get one coming in who would want a bit more than he was given and would be wanting, you know, I've heard about this bit of equipment, why can't I have this, and that gym should be better. But as long as you got on with the main hub of senior players, you'd be constant conversation with them. Yeah, I think wasn't really a pressure. I think there were times when we had to increase the numbers, where we got a third physio in, for example, or a second massage therapist. But as long as you're listening to them and the club are backing you with budgets for that and the manager's happy, I think you can always react to what the senior players want. As long as you agree with it, believe in it, and the club are behind it as well. We did an article, sorry to interrupt, we did an article, me and Gary, on the changing landscapes of sports medicine. So we compared Gary's 1987 season with Arsenal when he was there to my 2017 season. So like it was a comparison of 30 years apart, one season at a football club. And we did like a flow chart in it of the change in staffing levels, and it was nuts. The way staffing blew up around psychologists, nutritionists, podiatrist input, number of physios, number of massage therapists, strength coaches, and the way it blew up, it was unbelievable in the mid-2000s. For the right reasons, but it was a huge difference in 30 years.
I actually loved it in the chat with Gary. I think he was saying about when they went to Anfield, you know, with the famous Michael Thomas goal. It was basically, there was like three of them.
Yeah.
Was it George Graham? Was it Don Howe? Was Evie the other one?
George Graham, Theo Foley, the assistant manager. I think there was a kit man. Gary, that might have been it.
Yeah. No, I just think, yeah, I mean, nuts. How incredible to be a part of like such an iconic... Yeah. thing of English football. I'm an Everton fan, so I enjoyed that moment as well. So, so yeah, that is really interesting there, because I think seeing the shift of it between 87 and 17, I'm sure it is massive. And like you were, you know, you've kind of seen a big change as well in that time period. Mm. Do you have a preference of, did you enjoy one more than the other, or like, was, what, from your own personal perspective, what were your thoughts on like the working in both?
I think you enjoy, and I think any physio would say this, you enjoy it when it's your team. So Gary left in 2008 to go full time with the England men's national team, and I was given the title lead physio, head of medical, whatever it was at that time. So I led the medical team from 2008 onwards. For 10 years, and I think, yeah, that period was my favorite, because suddenly it was, you know, your team then, and the people we could build in that 10 years, the team we built in that time, I was really proud of it. The physios that we had working with us, the experience, quality physios we had working there, the introduction of the research and development team, we developed a new building at the training ground, we brought in a new doctor, Gary O'Driscoll, in 2009, and he was a great addition. You know, the physios, Andy Rolls, Ben Ashworth, spoken to Ben, I know you have, and Jimmy Haycock, Declan Lynch, Simon Harland, all these people that the club backed me to bring in. We built such a strong medical team and performance team with the likes of Shad Forsyth and Barry Solin coming in. We really built a good team. So I suppose because it was, I was steering the boat at that time, if you like, I suppose that's probably the time I was most proud of and probably enjoyed the most, despite the fact we only won a few FA Cups and not many leagues in that time.
Well, when you're recruiting them, you say they're a great recruit. So obviously, there's the medical aspect, but what do you see when you're recruiting someone, or whether it's in your own clinic or at Arsenal, what are you looking for from a characteristic perspective?
Yeah, it's hard, isn't it? You get a couple of hours with someone and a CV to try and judge them, I think. From our point of view at Arsenal, we were fortunate because Ivan Gazidis, the CEO, and the HR department, as well as Arsene, backed us with a budget, which meant I could go and get senior people, experienced people that have been in my position at other clubs. So when you're employing the likes of Andy Rolls, Ben Ashworth, Jimmy Haycock, or the most recent three in the last sort of 5 years there, I knew by employing them, they'd led teams elsewhere. So they had a lot of skills around leadership. They knew the pressures I'd be under, which was helpful. Apart from being quality physios, good people, the most important thing around that most of the time was no ego. I think working a team like that, which if you include everyone, was a team of sort of 15, 16, really. When you look at everyone in that team, medical admin, docs, massage therapists and stuff like that, between 12 and 16 people, you can't have egos, especially when it's a team game. So you do your best at those interviews to try and wheedle out the egos, try and speak to other people. Is it called soft referencing? I think it's called. And try and work out if any of them got any egos that might get in the way. And every now and then you're going to get one or two with a bit of an ego, and you know, you've got to work out whether you think their quality and what they can bring is worth taking that chance. In other words, the pros are going to well outweigh the con. They might have an ego, or you can manage it. So those were the biggest things. Mm. It was easier for us because we had the budget to bring in such senior people. Now, if I'm a physio, I'm just picking a team, I know a League Two team, and my budget is far, far less, it's a much harder recruitment process because you've got to go and find someone quality, experienced, who's willing to work for that different salary. And that's a much harder thing to do, I think. We had some great people. We turned down some great people to get the people I've talked about there.
Yeah, it was definitely difficult in an interview process. So it's difficult to get the full picture of what that person's like, or if it's right for them as well as for you.
Yeah, exactly. I think we were lucky that we had a lot of applicants for any role, perhaps because we were London, perhaps because Arsenal were doing well at the time and we had a reasonable reputation around the medical team. So we had some really, really good applicants, which was helpful. And so, yeah, I was really proud of the people we got in. And especially we could have some influence on the academy side as well. So when we brought Des Ryan in, sort of 2012-ish, I think, 11-12, again, I knew that would be a massive addition to the academy because suddenly he was going to overhaul the athletic development of our academy, which was a huge thing, which I'm really proud of.
Yeah, I really want to get Des on. I had a great meeting with him at your training ground, and just I think really interesting insight of development for the younger athlete, because he's back in Ireland now, isn't he?
Yeah, he's at Setanta, but we talked him into coming over back then, and not everyone was on board with it, to be honest, because he'd come from rugby and youth rugby, so a few people needed convincing that he was the right man, but he came in and made a massive difference. Yeah, and one of the best recruitments I've been part of, really. Really good.
Mm. But then in terms of, for you working in a football team, what is it like when you get a player comes to you and says they've got an injury or they've not got an injury, and then you're in the middle between, say, management and the player? How does that dynamic work in terms of where does your responsibilities, how do you manage the expectations of everyone? And from a professional standpoint, how does that all work for you?
I think your first duty is, you know, to the profession, really. We talk about club versus coach. I think the duty is to the profession. So honesty, integrity and everything else, those sort of words. But I think with experience, you get to know. Managers tell you things you can't always tell players. Players tell you things you can't always tell the manager. And I think knowing what level that filter needs to be at, because there has to be a filter. There's some things players tell you the manager has to know, and vice versa. And so I think that's just an experience, really. So the helpful thing we had with Arsene was being with him so many years. I think it was much easier to build trust. Now, if I'm at a club that's changing its manager every year, 18 months, just as you're starting to build some trust and that manager's starting to trust and respect your view and your opinion and your decisions, they get sacked and you start again. So I think we were very fortunate that Arsene was there for so long that we could build that trust, that which helped me enormously, because even if I didn't always get it right, Arsene might have trusted that view and the player might have trusted that view. So that's a big thing, I think, is building that trust.
I was going to say, in terms of like the R&D, so that the research department, so when that was being talked about, what was the remit given to you or the guys that were involved in building it?
No, there wasn't no remit. There was no remit. I think I met with a fellow called Alan McCall, who's a sports science background, research background, and he was working at Lille in France at the time. I think he'd been at Celtic before, Liverpool before. He was at Lille. And he came over, I think it was to chat about some potential research, I think, it's a while ago. And we were having a chat upstairs in the restaurant. And he showed me a database which had a load of journal articles on it, really well organized, really well arranged into different sections. So there was a physiotherapy section, a recovery section, an S&C section, nutrition section. And I said, well, what's that there? He said, oh, this is our database. So we look through the best 40, 50 journals every month, pick out the best articles and put them onto this database for the staff to look at. What? So I looked at all these articles and I said, what's that? Is that this year? And he said, no, that's this month. So looking at the database, thinking, well, there's 12 really good articles there that have been cherry picked because they're relevant to elite sport, mostly football, from all different faculties, if you like, of sports medicine, and someone else has found the best 12, put the abstracts on this database, and there's the article if you want to read it. You know, none of us have got time to do that. We're all trying to keep up to date. And I just thought, yeah, that's something we need. That's something our medical team needs. And so fast forward a few months, I was trying to talk Alan into coming to Arsenal to set that up, which is one of many parts of his role, and to do some other bits and pieces for us around pushing research in football. We have things called graded recommendations. We wrote an article with Claire Ardern on it where, I mean, you can imagine how many emails you get in a week with the new Wonder product. This will really work for your player. This great tablet, this infrared lamp, this new...
Most of them are for me, aren't they?
Sometimes. Sometimes. And but we got some hilarious ones. Yours aren't hilarious, Andy, but there were some hilarious ones. And you just didn't have time to filter through this, and you couldn't always assume it was always rubbish. And so everything went to Alan, the Black Magic file, it was called. All went to Alan, and he would go through it, filter out the ones that might have something, and they'd do something called a graded recommendation, where you get an expert opinion on it. He'd look at the research on it, the actual quality research, not the one that's funded by the same company, and grade it A to D. So anything that was A or B, we'd take a closer look at and perhaps get in. For example, a new compression sock, you know, a decent level compression sock, I think once got a B. We looked at it, it was reasonably priced, it was easily doable, why not, let's do it. But some of the D's might have been a brand new Wonder product where you clip these electrodes to your ear and it made you stronger, you know, this sort of stuff that we used to get sent. So these graded recommendations worked really well for us in that we could wheedle out the good from the bad. And so, yeah, that was another arm. We used to have monthly research and development meetings where the best three articles from that month were presented by someone. It was just the right thing to do, and I think it was a really good thing to have. I think it's still there now, perhaps not in the same guise, but he's still there now.
That's interesting. And then in terms of like your involvement with the manager, who would you report into for any of this information, like the non-specific playing side?
For the stuff we're talking about with the R&D?
Yeah, I mean, kind of anything really. I guess who did you report into anyone other than the manager, for example?
No, I think the CEO was always keen to be kept abreast of anything that was going on, with Arsene's permission, of course. So I spoke to Ivan Gazidis a fair bit about important stuff. Obviously Arsene about almost everything. And the way we ran it, me and Gary O'Driscoll didn't really run it as a I'm your line manager, you're my line manager. We ran it alongside each other. And so, yeah, between me and Gary, we would answer upwards, really, to Arsene and Ivan Gazidis, really.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's a big thing, that, isn't it? Like, it's a multi-million pound business, basically. And you're a very important cog dealing with serious business people as well. So it's quite a multi-faceted skill set that you've got to have in that role.
Yeah, I think if you're the head of that particular department, yeah, but I think that's the same for anywhere, isn't it? I think I was only 50% clinical, 50% managerial, if that, on the clinical in the last few years, because it was so easy for me to let the physios carry on doing what they were doing. They were 40-ish years old with 20-ish experience and knew exactly what they were doing. It was an easy managerial role, so I could get up to date on those sort of things and manage upwards a bit better.
And then, so when, like, what point did you think it was coming to an end at Arsenal? Like, how did it come that you set up the Lewin Clinic? How did you come to leave?
2018, when Arsene left, it was decided by the performance director at the time that he wanted to make some changes. And so I left then. In the few months after, well, in the weeks after that, actually, two of the other physios left and went to other roles, and another one then moved on. So the whole of that medical team, the doctor stayed, massage therapist stayed, our PA stayed, Sophie, which was great. So that kept in place. And that performance director brought in some physios he knew. And so that went that direction. And so I had a year then of bits and pieces here and there, going to look around different sports injury clinics to see how they were doing things, not particularly working in them, but just seeing how they were doing things. because I'll be very naive in the area, having worked in sport for so long, to then go and look at how these clinics run things as a business was a real eye-opener and a real steep learning curve. So everyone was very open, spoke to a lot of people about how they do it, why they do it, what mistakes they've made. I did a really short-term contract with Bristol City, did a few months with them, helping them set up their loan player medical management. Andy Rolls was in charge at the time, so he took me in there for a few months to do that with them. And we opened this place with a bit of backing from three investors in October 2019, 6 months before COVID.
So, like, putting it together, what was the vision when you were putting together it? Because, again, you've got to get investors, albeit they're high-profile ones, I'm sure they'll still want to see some substantial information.
Yeah, we haven't mentioned them, have we? So the three investors are Petr Cech, Aaron Ramsey and Mesut Ozil, players I worked with in my last 5-10 years at the club. And the vision was, because we thought it was a gap in the market, to provide elite level rehab facilities and therapists for everyone. There seemed to be a big gap in the MSK world where there was decent MSK physio, but if you're an elite level athlete, I don't think the experience within the therapists or the facilities were available. So that was the idea in setting it up. There was something similar in Reading called Go Perform. I think you've spoken to him. Luke.
Yeah.
Go Perform. Spent a lot of time with them, seeing what they were doing. Luke Anthony finally came to me. And so there's only really Go Perform that were doing it well. And since R4P is set up as well, I think we advised them a little bit as well. So Go Perform, us and R4P all shot up in the same sort of 3-4 years. And yeah, the idea was to have therapists that had worked with elite athletes, and that everyone would have access to that expertise, if that's what you want to call it, with a facility that matched. So that was the plan. So we got those three players to back it, opened up, didn't expect a pandemic 6 months later. So things were a little bit behind, but yeah, it's enjoyable. It's good because we get elite level athletes, heavyweight boxers, you know, professional tennis players, a lot of professional footballers coming through the door, along with people that live 100 metres away who had a knee replacement last week. So it's a real mix and match of characters and conditions.
Yeah, no, your social media is really interesting. It's always, if people don't follow you, it's worth doing, because you definitely get a lot of people through. Like, I saw you doing stuff with Soccer Aid as well. And
Yeah, Soccer Aid's been good. We've been doing that the last 4 years. Really interesting, 5 days away with a real good mix of people. And, you know, it's for UNICEF, and so that's a good part of it. But it's a really enjoyable 5 days. Football's not top level, but the people are a good laugh, and that's really a really good fun 4 or 5 days.
And then, so how has it been for you then? So previously you're employed, you know, it's still going to be a high-pressure environment. You're working for a top Premier League team. How do the pressures change from that to having your own business and investors to report into and that sort of thing?
I think we're lucky that the investors are fairly quiet. You know, we inform them what's going on every few months with reports and numbers and stuff like that. So we're lucky on that side. I think the job itself is just a lot more, I've said this to a few people recently, it's a lot more emotionally stable. It's so the physiotherapy side of things, there's a lot less ups and downs. I never have a dreadful day here. I never have a mind-blowing day here. That's what you know, that's the right word. Whereas in football, you'd have two of those in the same week, where you'd have a real dreadful day and a day where everything's gone your way and you leave work buzzing.
Can you give me an example of each of that at Arsenal?
Well, it's fairly obvious, and sadly, it's probably results-based. I think if you get on the bus after winning the North London Derby at Spurs, after a night match, you get on that bus, you get back to the training ground about midnight, and you get in your car and you think, that's been a great day. And it shouldn't be results-based, but it is, because it means so much to your week and the atmosphere at the training ground, the results. So even seeing a long-term rehab get back on a pitch, you know, you see a long-term rehab, get back on a pitch and get through a whole game, that's a really big part of your day. That's really, you're left feeling delighted. Conversely, you lose a home game, an important home game, or you get knocked out of an important cup and you are getting in your car very down. I think that's the same for any physio at any club, surely. But I think you don't get that in the clinic environment. And that may be an unusual thing to say, I don't know. But I don't often get in the car buzzing or fed up.
I've just won Soccer Aid.
Yeah, no, not the same. Not the same. I'm delighted I've been at Soccer Aid and helped to raise that money for you, Yusuf. But the result, I don't remember any of the results.
So just out of interest, like, are there any particular games that you can vividly remember getting back on the bus and just thinking, wow, that was just incredible?
Again, it sounds like I'm being big-headed, but we won 7 FA Cups when I was there. So we lost one, and that's the one you remember, annoyingly. Michael Owen, Liverpool, 2001, I think. But, yeah, 7 FA Cup finals. To get back on a bus with the cup at Wembley, to go back to the training ground, well, sometimes it was Cardiff. But, yeah, it doesn't get a lot better than that. They're the obvious ones, just the big cup games. But I've also been on the bench. I've lost a few Carling Cup finals. I've been on the losing bench at a Champions League final. Been on the losing bench at a UEFA Cup final. So, yeah, you also get the other end of that scale.
Yeah. Yeah, they're definitely there in an incredible period for the club. And then in terms of just like when you're, again, recruiting, How does it differ when you're recruiting for people at your current clinic? Is there any differences between that and when you're recruiting at the club? I know that the people coming through will be slightly different with their skill sets and potentially budgets, but how does it differ?
There's less soft referencing to call on. Again, with people we've employed here, have both been very good employment so far, Manny and Laura. In football, I could call on 2, 3, 4 people who I knew would even know the person I was about to employ, or would know someone who knew the person I was about to employ. HR used to go mad, but we'd always try and do a little bit of background if we could. So I think here we were looking for experience, attitude, work ethic, all the things you look for in football. But ego was less of an issue because in a clinic, you're in a room most of the time, one-on-one, or in the gym with them. But the constant connect, if you like, is one-on-one. So if Laura or Manny had a bit of an ego, I'd be much more likely to take a chance on them in clinic, because their ego with them in a room with someone else is fine by me. They haven't got to work so much as part of a team like you did in elite sport, I don't think. That's the thing that jumps to mind, really. In clinic, obviously, we're looking for vast experience with some links to sport, ideally, because we're a sports injury clinic, and it helps that they've both worked in a level of sport. And I've learned a lot from both of them, really, on the business side of things, because they've worked in clinics far longer than I've worked in a clinic. So they've been really good in telling me a lot of things that we were getting wrong here that they've seen elsewhere. So I think, yeah, they were good employment so far, but again, it's hard. You don't get the level of applicant, if you know what I mean. We're just a clinic, a sports injury clinic in East London, Essex now. We're not Arsenal Football Club. There's a different attraction to working at those two different places. And so, again, we've been very fortunate. We haven't made any bad decisions. We've got two really good physios so far. But I suppose there will come a time where there may be a not so good employee. Who knows?
Yeah, all that's all part of the journey as well, isn't it?
Yeah, sure.
Sometimes you don't get them. And then, so just final question then. So what would your advice be for people looking to get into, whether it's sports, whether it's their own clinic, or even just the area of rehab physio? What would your advice be?
I think there's two different questions there. I think the question you first asked was someone wanted to get into sport. do the early stuff, you know, do the voluntary stuff, do the academy stuff, do the stuff where you work on a Wednesday night and a Sunday morning, and not being paid so well. Network massively. Go to any conference you can go to. It hasn't always got to be the expensive one in Denmark or the expensive one in London. There's lots of different events that go on. The FA Medical Society is a good one. It's gone a bit online recently, but it used to be a really good evening session where you meet a lot of good people. So I think it's getting your face known, and being willing to do the not so glamorous stuff of the Wednesday nights and Sunday mornings, is the obvious thing to say. And take your time. I mean, my route into this was awful nepotism, really, wasn't it? My cousin employed me. That wouldn't be allowed to happen now. So my route now would be very different. I'd be doing the few years of voluntary, the academy stuff and stuff like that. So the sport side of things, I would say do as many courses as you can, get on the conferences and be prepared to do the hard graft. Clinic-wise, I don't know. I'm only 4 years in, Andy. I'm not the expert. I don't think I can advise anyone on that. I think, again, we look at the CVs and look for education, experience, and after that, sit them down and interview and see how they come across. But I'll still be making mistakes at that. We're only 4 years in. I'm not sure I'm the best man to advise.
Yeah. No, well, I still think it's good insight, because I think really a lot of it, like some of the feedback we've had on these chats, and even from my perspective when we're recruiting, is the clinical bit is obviously important, but it's that the fits, the culture, the drive, the personality is massive in it as well.
Yeah, the work ethic, it is, because, yeah, what did someone say to me once? Employ attitude, coach talent, which makes complete sense to me. So get someone in on their attitude. Obviously, I'm not suggesting you employ someone who's rubbish, who's got a great attitude, but, you know, if you can employ someone with a great attitude, they're going to be doing their own learning anyway, first of all. And you can put in place internal, external CPD. You're going to make them into something that's very good. But again, here we employ not the finished product, but we employ experienced physios. We're not taking on 3, 4, 5 years physios qualified at this stage. We might. But by employing attitude and then coaching the talent, I think that's a great way of thinking about it.
No, brilliant. No, that's a great way to sign off. So, Colin, I really appreciate your time today and sharing some of the insights. I'm a bit of an Arsenal fanboy of that period, as probably a lot of people are. I really appreciate you sharing your insights, and good luck with the Lewin Clinic, and I hope it continues to grow and prosper.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me on.
Cheers. Thanks, Colin. See you soon. Cheers.